Welcome to the Make or Miss podcast. This is Seth Partnow. I'm joined today by Talking Practice, the pseudonym of the proprietor of Talking Practice blog and well-known NBA gambler and analyst on Twitter. You can follow him at Talking Practice, and hope you enjoy as we talk about one number analytics, who's done well this summer, and a little bit about our mutual love of the Boston Celtics and what we think that they, how we think they've done this summer. So enjoy and thanks for listening.
One of the things that we briefly before we started recording is I was always under the impression that in the past there was kind of a gap between NBA good and gambling good in terms of who actually does things on the court versus does things that helps you. But you were saying that with some of the new stuff we're doing, that gap is kind of closed.
Yeah, I think over the last few years, it's definitely closed. In general, I think markets become more efficient over time. So I guess that's not surprising. It's just like any other market, just like a stock or a bond market. The analytics movement, though, has definitely worked its way into gambling a lot. So I think when we talked earlier, I mentioned Draymond Green, for example, 3-4 years ago. A guy like Draymond Green getting hurt, but, you know, that wouldn't move the line at all. Nowadays, Draymond Green, it's very clear how good a player he is in the line. A lot of the Rackham kind of guys that maybe several years ago didn't really have the kind of line value, a guy like Tony Allen or Amir Johnson. Obviously, I'm ecstatic Amir Johnson's on the Celtics now. all those kind of guys now have a lot of activity. They'll create a lot of line movement, and back in the day, they wouldn't have it. You know, Amir Johnson getting hurt in 2011 would have done nothing. Absolutely nothing. And now you'll see a lot of those Rackham kind of guys get hurt, like a late minute injury, and you'll see the line move a half point right away. So I think things have closed up a lot recently. I blame Jerry Engelman a lot for it, for RPM and stuff. RPM has definitely helped close the gap quite a bit.
So you said something there, which I kind of wanted, the main reason I wanted to talk with you is it's actually a point of discussion is you said it's clear how good Draymond Green is now. And kind of an open-ended question and leading the witness, is it clear how good he is, or is there still plenty we don't know, and maybe an RPM one number thing is just a kind of a better, almost a better guess at what it is he does on the basketball court?
Okay, so I guess I think more people on Twitter have noticed that you and I, as we talked about earlier, have been on an island. So in terms of one-number metrics, while I have one and while I use them every day, I think they're probably overused in a lot of ways. A main one is just the issue you said there. There's when you look at a number for any of these guys, the standard deviation around these numbers, I think, is substantially larger than people think. So, if we want to make up a number for Draymond Green, call him, say, a +4 or something, in the standard plus-minus model, I mean, that's really something like 4 plus or minus 3 or something. So, I mean, he could be anywhere from a 1 to a 7. I guess in his case, maybe it's a little more narrow than that. But the confidence intervals around the numbers, I think, are substantially larger than a typical fan realizes. I think it's pretty clear to everyone now that Draymond Green is good. But the idea that from the one-number metrics we can be really, really sure, I think it's greatly exaggerated. Particularly, you see this in guys change teams. I know how good Draymond Green was this past year for Golden State. I do not know how good he would be if he ended up getting signed by Detroit or something. Now, I'm pretty confident he's very good. But you can see this with a guy like Josh Smith, too. He was so good in Atlanta, so bad in Detroit, now good again in Houston. And a lot of it is the context-dependent nature of the numbers, I think, isn't as well-known as it maybe should be. The one-number metric, the numbers are highly, highly, highly context-dependent. I mean, in my case, it's no big secret. I think I've made known that when a guy changes teams and stuff, I barely look at the old data sometimes. At least the old plus-minus data, we go through that fast and we don't look at it anymore really quickly. You can see the example really well with Josh Smith, I think. After 3 or 4 games in Houston, I think it would be clear to anybody that what he had done in Detroit is not really that relevant in Houston. We kicked out Detroit numbers almost immediately on Josh Smith because it was, I think, very, very clear. So I think that the two main areas probably where the plus-minus metrics are maybe looked at a little deceivingly, I would summarize that as context dependency, particularly in terms of role on team, and the size of the confidence interval around the numbers. When I say a guy's a +5, I really mean he's between, +3 and +7, or it's actually probably wider than that for most guys. And I think that's something the average fan probably doesn't know yet.
And those are both very important, just because those numbers, partially it's just economy of language, and partially it's because it sounds better when you can say, well, he's the third best player in the league because this number says so. But really, he's in this clump of people who are around the same. And but more importantly than that, it's within, like you said, and I think I beat this drum constantly too, is within the context of he's getting these shots, guarding these kind of people, you know, having the defender running at him this way because of you know, all those little micro things that go into basketball that you're using a one number metric to kind of capture are different. So it's and essentially we're saying nothing more revolutionary than when things are different, they're different.
I think that's very much true. They're also usually a lot of the numbers that we've made about and stuff are really descriptive, not predictive. So even the particular RPM that Jerry posts every day, or that's on ESPN, or, you know, that's the descriptive one that says basically how people have played or how their performance has been, I guess you could say, so far this year. It's not necessarily how they're likely to play tomorrow, or it's not necessarily how good they are. I mean, it's definitely not good how good they are. So if someone gives a ranking of guys, you know, a ranking of guys, and I don't want to keep talking about RPM, so I'll just use my own, for example. You know, if I give out a top 20 ICV list or something, and we did do this for years, and I think it's a big tip-off that I don't think they're super valuable, is that I gave them away for free, right? So if it was, you know, super-duper valuable, I wouldn't be telling everybody with as much precision as I could how good the top 20 or 25 guys are. So I think the descriptive, non-predictive nature is something that's missed too. There's another thing too, and I hope I'm not rambling now, but I think one reason the standard deviations I've shown is that they're pretty hard to calculate. It's highly non-trivial for some of the box score and form numbers to calculate a standard deviation. In fact, internally, we use a couple of workarounds, a couple of tricks or assumptions along the way to try to get a good result. So I think one reason they're not published is that the number doesn't necessarily mean anything. You know, it would be a little bit arbitrary the way those standard deviations were given. One other failing with the one number metrics, I think, is that you see often people refer to someone who say scores. I'll just use IPV as an example, but a guy who has a high IPV and a high RPM and a high BPM and stuff, and the suggestion somehow comes that these are somehow confirming each other, but I don't think that's that true. I mean, I'm sure it's definitely a little bit true, but we're really comparing three things that are the same, right? So,
right.
You know, when A, B, and C are all the same, you can't say when you, oh, we have A, B, and C, yay, it's more evidence. I mean, it doesn't really work that way. And I think that's missed a lot. You know, you can't look at a guy who has a good BPM, a good RPM, and a good IPV and act like that's substantially more evidence. Yeah, it's maybe like 1.5 times as good and not 3 times as good. Yeah, I think that's missed a lot too.
The analogy that I've used before is kind of, I mean, this is getting into kind of real world stuff, but kind of the mortgage crisis was, all right, you have three houses on a block. If all three houses are owned by people who work at the same factory, you're not really reducing your risk that much by, you know, by rolling them together and making one kind of dead instrument with all three of those, because if one of them loses their job, that's, you know, you probably know something, the others might lose their job too. So
I think that's a very good analogy. Actually, I mean, I'm afraid I'm going to get my head chopped off later for some of this stuff. You know, and definitely these are different metrics and stuff. But I mean, BPM is made using long run RAPM, for example, as independent variable and stuff. So it's like they are all really similar. Or if you look at our IPV list versus Jerry's RPMs, they're so similar now. Every year, I think they're converging on each other more and more. And you know, I get a tweet now and then from somebody who says, oh, his RPM's really high and your IPV's really high for him too, so he must be good. And I mean, that's ridiculous. That's the two houses on the block next to each other owned by the same guy.
Yeah, and again, it's a non-trivial difference between, I feel like we're at a certain point, we're kind of going to become dueling pianos here, I think, on this topic. But the difference between he has performed this way and he is this good is, you know, it's often similar, but it's the difference is kind of non-trivial. And that's a, you know, maybe he was hurt, maybe he was sick, maybe he was being played out of position, maybe, you know, all these other things that, you know, we can look at qualitatively and say, this is why he has played worse. He is not a worse player. He has been in a less ideal situation.
Yeah, you saw that with JR. Yeah, you said that really well, I think, with JR last year. leaving the disaster environment and going to Cleveland. I think everyone knows what a Celtics homer I am, but I think of the Courtney Lee example from a couple of years ago. He definitely wasn't that good for us. And then he went to Memphis and he changes the whole lineup by giving them some spacing and a shooter that they didn't have. I think that the biggest key on how context-dependent numbers is when a guy changes teams, really. When a guy changes teams, he obviously automatically usually changes role in some way. It's probably a little harder, I think, to see when a guy changes role within team. Also, the plus-minus things have a hell of a sample size need that I think maybe isn't as good. You can get an idea for how good a shooter a guy is a lot quicker than you can get a good idea for how good he actually is on the court, because we need so many games of data to really pick this stuff up. And I think another thing there is because you need a lot of games of data to pick these things up, we sometimes can't get inflection points quite as well. So Rappen was maybe a little behind on guys like Anthony Davis or something, all the one-number metrics, maybe a little bit behind on here DeMarcus, and I think we maybe you'll miss on the other end with guys like, when Tony Allen gets old, because we're going to consider other seasons with Tony Allen, we may not quite catch as much. So I think the sample size issue gets left out a little bit too. We need very, very large samples for our plus-minus type models.
Sure. So moving away from kind of the hardcore kind of the numbers, what are kind of some things some qualitative things that you would look for in changing teams to, or, all right, he's moving to a better spot, he's moving to a worse spot. One of the guys at Nylon Calculus is actually, he just came up with something today where and I'm maybe stealing his thunder a little bit, but he's writing it up and I'm very much looking forward to it, is a suggestion that players kind of at the extreme, either end, sort of, when they change teams, tend to fairly strongly regress towards the mean. Because if they're at the extremes, that probably means they're in a very bad situation, especially if they're in enough demand to actually find a new team.
Right.
But what are kind of some of the more finite skills that you might look for? I mean, I think the Courtney Lee example is a good one, in that he was kind of duplicative in Boston and unique in Memphis. Therefore, he was more impactful for Memphis. Is that kind of how you would?
I think that's a classic. When we look a lot at a guy, if you're Courtney Lee was a really good one, yes. So if you're in a team that has a lot of shooting, you move a guy who's not needed there so much to a team that needs spacing really bad, and we look at that a lot. A guy who can set a screen, you may have several guys in a team who can set a good screen, and you go to another team and goddamn, there's nobody who can set a proper freaking screen. moving those guys can change a lot, and several players all of a sudden things open up. Same with the pick and roll, or defending the pick and roll. I think a lot of that, when you see a guy change teams, depending on where they are in that side of the spectrum, how they defend the pick and roll, you can see a lot. I'm curious, so a guy like Draymond, if he goes to another team where he wasn't, Draymond's such a key focal point of that defense, and if he goes to another team where it's not that same kind of need, we're not going to want to switch that much for Breeze and stuff, he may lose a lot of his value. I think a lot of what we see for kind of individual needs things are usually floor spacing, I think, is the big one, but then something around the screens or pick and roll, either offensively or defensively. A lot too with how coaches decide to run on defense, so whether they're going to crash the boards or whether they're going to send everybody back. If a guy's in an environment where he was always getting sent back and all of a sudden they're not going to run everybody back, that could change things just so dramatically. So I think a lot of it depends. I think a lot of the stuff for us, though, comes down to what one team has or has in abundance and the other one does or does not have. And does a guy moving fill a hole, or does he just jump in and fit an area where it's already not that needed?
That can
depend, I guess, on a lot of factors. I feel like I just summarized a few, and there are probably a ton more I didn't think of.
Well,
the easiest way to say
it sounds to me like you're from your descriptions of things that kind of matter, you're very excited about your Johnson coming to Boston then, since you're talking about like a guy who can set a screen and defend the pick and roll, and it's like, oh, that's the check.
He wasn't in the back of my head at all. No, I didn't think that at all when I said this. No, yeah, okay. Yeah, I couldn't be happier to have Amir Johnson in Boston, obviously. I was over the moon about having Amir Johnson in Boston.
Though at the same time, he's also maybe at a spot where, what you're talking about, he's no longer super young and got a lot of miles on him and has picked up kind of niggling injuries, so maybe – the other caveat about the numbers being slow to catch up to like a real world decline. But at the same time, this is getting into contract value and stuff like that. I mean, the risk was so low. It's kind of a no-brainer thing, I guess.
I think so. His plus minus numbers did start to come in a bit last year. I hope that with a lot of all the constant nagging injuries, that he plays through them so much. I hope as opposed to the age. But definitely his wrap-up came in a bit. As a Celtics fan, I think that the fear for me, the negative, is that Masai would give him up. And, you know, he obviously is asymptomatic. You know, he has a lot more information here than we do on Celtics side. But I'm super happy to take this gamble on the particular contract we have for Amir Johnson. Super, super happy about it.
Sure. So one of the other interesting things that I think, kind of the one number metrics, and again, I guess I kind of have a reputation for being a one number basher, just because I'm and I just want to again be clear that I'm not. It's just like all the things we've been talking about. It's a useful, but it's not the Bible of basketball value. But one of the interesting things to come out of it is, especially kind of now coming out of the draft, you know, expectations are sky high. I mean, you saw, you know, for example, people who wanted to kill the Knicks for drafting Porzingis. It was like, well, draft an NBA ready guy. And it's like, well,
right.
In those methodologies, you basically assume a pretty hefty negative value to any rookie because they've historically been very not good. That's right.
Yeah, I think the standard methodology for rookies that most guys in the wager markets use and most people use in analytics is just to assume that they're a -2 or -3 per 100 possession kind of player. I'm not sure how accurate that is. I can say that trying to estimate value for first-year guys is such a ridiculous crapshoot. You know, no one has any idea. I pretty much don't believe for a second that anyone has any idea how good anybody's going to be this year. I think we have a better chance of forecasting a guy's career practically than we do this year. I have no idea. A lot of the guys who come in allegedly NBA ready, that turns out to not be true at all. And I'm not talking, you know, Euros. I mean, a guy like Mirotić, several people told me he was going to be quite good. But some of these younger guys, yeah, I have no idea who's going to, whether, you know, whether Towns is going to be better than Okafor this year or vice versa. I have absolutely no idea.
And almost who cares this year?
Who cares this year? Right? Definitely true.
But I think it's more instructive for anything else that you know, they're going to come in and be, you know, obviously, you know, for various, whether it's win projections or anything like that, knowing how not good they're going to be is important. But the point remains is that you're kind of starting from a standpoint of you know, there's a lot of actual learning that has to go on, whatever the box score stats end up being, that guys aren't actually that positively impactful on the court. Am I off base or am I preaching to the choir still?
I mean, I think it's absolutely true. I feel like there are people that don't accept it. I think Neil Payne did a good job last year, though I didn't agree with a lot of his comments about Andrew Wiggins. I think he did a good job explaining how rookies tend to generally think, and I think Jerry wrote something about that as well. But I guess it's kind of common knowledge now that rookies, for the most part, tend to stink, and it's just an element of what degree of stink it's going to be. I think even LeBron was not a substantially good player his rookie year. You know, Kevin Durant was an extreme negative. So, I think it's becoming more common knowledge that rookies are going to, for the most part, stink in the first year. But I guess I'm not sure. I think it's more dramatic. It's definitely more dramatic than the average fan realizes. You know, it's definitely not like Karl Towns is going to come in and move the needle substantially this current year for Minnesota. There's just no way.
They're going to be more interesting than good this year.
I think that's definitely true. Sort of
like last year, if they'd have been healthy, they would have been, you know, an entertaining bad team, whereas as opposed to with Rubio out for most of the year, they were just a bad team, a depressing bad team.
I think that's right. Rookies are fun to watch. Yeah, I mean, they're fun to watch in summer league. I love this time of year because the free agency is so much fun, and then the trades start coming along, they're so much fun, and summer league's so much fun. Some of the most fun for the rookies for me, frankly, is summer league, seeing them play for the first time. Once the season gets going, it's barely any more fun than summer league.
Sure. Speaking of summer league, and sorry to take a left turn on you here, but speaking of summer league and kind of player movement and stuff like that, you know, it occurs to me that this offseason has been one of the stranger ones we've seen. I mean, a lot has been talked about, you know, the cap jump and all that stuff. But it almost seems like everyone is operating in uncharted territory. And what I mean by that is I looked at this a couple weeks ago. It's like we've been averaging about 3% rise in the salary cap every year for about 15 years. And this year it's like 40%. And just what the craziness of what that's done. And I just want, in general terms, how do you think that the players in the league and I kind of feel for the most part everyone has been, for the most part, pretty sensible about it. And that's surprising and encouraging, I guess. Would you agree with that? Or is there, you know, obviously people are going to make mistakes because we're, you know, equilibrium is completely blown up. But there have been fewer just ghastly kind of misvalues either way, it kind of seems like.
I definitely feel that way as well. I think in previous years, some of the contracts that people thought were terribly ghastly turned out to so not be the case because of the cap. I remember people crucifying me last year when I was happy about the Avery Bradley deal. And I mean, now his contract looks totally fine. Yeah, obviously some of the things Sacramento were offering seem hilarious, but I mean, it's not like they signed any of those players anyway. But I agree. It's hard with the cap the way it is, I guess, to make a totally atrocious contract. If anything, I'm surprised that there were some very good contracts over the last few days. I'm surprised they went down, given the nature of the cap and stuff. Yeah, I feel like Reggie Jackson's deal, was that yesterday, the day before yesterday, he got so much flack and stuff. I don't know how that's going to go. My general thesis tends to be most of these deals that look horrible are probably not going to be that bad when you look at them 2 years from now. Of course, as I say all the time, I'm wrong so often that this could be one of them. But I think many of these allegedly bad contracts are not going to end up looking that bad.
Sure. Although a lot of them in that one, my issue with I did not like the Reggie Jackson contract at all. My issue with that was more that, I mean, if that's where they ended up in, you know, that's okay, whatever. But it seems like it seems so much like, given the market and the restricted free agency and stuff like that, that they negotiated themselves up to that amount rather than, you know, it's like why spend so much capital putting like the very restrictive free agency in the collective bargaining agreement and then just giving that advantage away when you're actually negotiating with players?
Yeah, I picked probably about, I didn't love that contract. I didn't love that contract either. I should have picked it before. I don't love that contract either. It did seem like he was negotiating with himself the whole time, but I'm not sure why.
Yeah. No, but more talking about something like, you know, the Damari Carroll contract, which, you know, you see that number, whoa. I mean, he's been a pretty good player for 2 years after being a decent player in Utah. And it's like, well, that's $60 million for that guy. Wow. I think you kind of saw some of that sticker shock on the first day, especially. But I think for the most part, it seems like with the growing cap, none of them are going to end up being too bad. So, but you in general agree with me that the league has reacted mostly sensibly to the new environment.
I really think that. Yeah. Other than whatever the hell is going on in Sacramento, which no one knows what in the hell is going on in Sacramento. But yeah, other than that, I think we've responded very well to it. And there's obviously uncertainty in it, and I think it's been handled properly.
Let me float a theory to you and just get your thought on this. It's something that I've kind of been jokingly talking about is, you know, since none of this stuff has actually happened yet, why shouldn't Sacramento just not do that deal? They can still, with some juggling, I think can find a way to honor all the, like, the free agent contracts they've agreed to by other means and just not do that trade with Philadelphia.
Right. I've thought about this too, and I actually thought you were talking about that a bit today, and I've thought about this as well. I guess I've thought of the example of when a prosecutor gives a plea bargain. I think sometimes they want to get out. You're a lawyer, you tell me, but I think sometimes the prosecutors want to get out of them, and they don't because they're afraid of future plea bargains they give and that no one's going to trust them. And I think that's the only reason they're not backing out of this. I guess they're probably afraid that if they do, then, you know, going forward, who's going to trust whatever the hell they're involved in? But otherwise, I don't know how they're not trying to get out. I don't know how they're not trying to get out of that.
And I guess the only part that makes this kind of more almost is if ever there was a team where playing to the exact letter of the law would be kind of, well, turnabout's fair play. It would be the,
yeah,
this model of it. And I don't think this is that's not an ethical way to behave or anything like that. And I would hope I would never, you know, find myself in a situation to do that. But it's just as a thought experiment. So I don't know. If ever there was a time or a place where a team might want to back up, it might just be that this might be the time. Also, I don't know that they can hurt their reputation much, that much worse anyway. I mean, they're such a laughing stock of the league that they may almost seem smarter if they do it, maybe.
If I may, like the kind of flip side of that is if no one will deal with them for a year, until they get their house kind of in order, is that the worst thing? You know,
it'll just stop them from making further mistakes. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's probably the best thing for them to be unable to do anything for a year or so.
I'm
fine with. Yeah, anything they do is fine with me as long as DeMarcus Cousins eventually ends up in Boston. As long as that happens, I'm fine with anything, basically.
So, speaking of DeMarcus Cousins, who's kind of what would you have, you know, putting yourself in their shoes, like one of the deals that was floated was kind of something like the pick that ended up being D'Angelo Russell, Jordan Clarkson, Julius Randle. I was kind of the opinion that's still an underpay for DeMarcus Cousins. Is that you with me on that, or is that about the ballpark where you just say, okay, now we're talking, or just no?
I think I'm notoriously overweight on Cousins. I thought his turning point year was 2014, and I think most thought it was 2015. I personally think that deal is ridiculous. I think that deal is ridiculous. For a second, I don't think that's close. I don't think it's even close. That I could look like an idiot now in 6 months if Russell turns out to be really good. And I actually think Russell could turn out to be very, very good. But DeMarcus is already substantially better than Russell. Russell's very unlikely to ever be as good as DeMarcus is now. Of course, he could be wonderful, but I think that deal's crazy. Randle coming off the injury and something, I don't think that's even close. I don't think it's close.
That's a little bit where I came down to. All right, so... moving on a little bit, I mean, we've mentioned that we're both Celtics fans who do a better or worse job of hiding that. I think people are usually surprised when they find out I'm a Celtics fan. But
I remember, yeah, the first time I found out, it was just because geographically, I was very surprised geographically, and then you explained to me why. But I was so excited the first time I heard the first time I heard that you were one. You know, immediately there's a bond there, Seth, as soon as I heard this.
Exactly. Their off season seems to have been in two parts for me. There was the draft, which I didn't like at all, and their free agency, which I liked a great deal. And maybe start last with the David Lee trade today. When it originally came across, I was a little surprised that they didn't get anything kind of along with David Lee for basically doing Golden State a favor of saving them whatever it'll end up being $20 million in actual money, factoring in the luxury tax. And I was surprised they couldn't get anything. But then looking at, you know, the money that's still out there and the dearth of free agents, maybe cap space isn't worth what it was. So I don't know. But
yeah, there was a 5 or 6 minute window there maybe when the trade got announced where I don't think we were totally sure what else was involved. And I was, you know, 95%+ sure that there were picks coming back. So I also was very surprised there were no picks coming back. I think we don't know what trades might be coming for Boston if there's other stuff we're up to. I think it's possible we're up to other cool stuff that maybe would make this make more sense. I think it's also possible we just really want to make a push for the playoffs for a year and just keep trying to get better and create an environment where other people are going to want to come either via trades or via free agency that people are going to want to come to Boston. In the very short term, I mean, you know, I'm not a huge fan of David Lee, don't get me wrong. I mean, he's definitely a better player right now than Gerald Wallace is. So I guess in the short term, this has most likely made our team better. I was very, very surprised, though, that there was not any kind of pick or something coming back. I was really surprised. I was beyond really surprised, yeah. However, I've thus far, you know, the draft is a different story. I guess I don't have a huge opinion on the draft other than I was very surprised by our draft pick. I didn't run, you know, in previous last couple of years, we'd run a lot of draft metrics and stuff, and we didn't do them this year. So I don't have as big an opinion as I would usually. But I definitely was surprised by the draft. But I love our free agency. Obviously, love Amir Johnson signing. I think Jarupko was extremely underrated, and I think we got him in a great deal.
And I'm enamored with Jay Crowder. I think it was a little surprise from most of the basketball community to get such a long deal. But I think any Celtics fan, that obviously his number on our kind of metrics, on the plus-minus metrics, have always been substantially better than his box just got to indicate. And anybody who watched this guy play last year once he came to Boston, I think, could see why we wanted to keep him. So I'm ecstatic with the Crowder signing and the Jarepko signing, in addition to the Amir thing. The draft, I'm gonna have faith that we knew something that everybody didn't about the draft. I'm just gonna have a lot of faith. That's what I'm gonna
sure. Do. And then when the news came out about, you know, Charlotte turning down the offers that they turned, and then who knows, you know, it's a bunch of picks. Well, they turned down the 2017, 18, 19, and 20 second rounders. Like, oh, okay. But you know, I can imagine being Danny Ainge and just being like super frustrated. Like, I've worked so hard to build up all these draft assets, and you won't let me. I have all this money, you won't let me spend. Why won't you let me spend this money?
Yeah. I think it's possible that I'm pretty sure we'd expected to be involved in some big stuff on and around the draft, and it just didn't materialize. And I guess there's a reasonable argument that, you know, we could have panicked, we could have, you know, steamed and done something kind of silly, and obviously we didn't do anything crazy. So there was probably the chance to make some bad deals we didn't make. So maybe in the future we'll be able to look at some deals we could have made, did not make out of panic and are happy with. I'm trying to find a bright side on the draft. There's got to be a bright side there, and I'm going to find it.
Well, it's, you know, the one bright side is picking where they picked. I mean, if you miss, it's not really a big deal. You know, it's not great, but if you get a rotation like an above average rotation player at 16, you've actually done well. So
yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah, it's not like there was anybody on the board that is like, oh my gosh, we have to have this guy. How did we pass on this guy? I don't think anything like that existed this year, and I'm pretty confident we wanted a trade up and a good deal just didn't materialize.
Yeah. So in terms of overall off seasons, do you have any kind of thoughts, whether, you know, qualitative, you know, just based on kind of basketball fandom or quantitatively? And of course, I think for both of us, those kind of run together a little bit. You think some people who've had them, I mean, I think we've talked enough about Sacramento. I feel fairly confident in putting them at 30 in terms of, you know, if we're force ranking off seasons, you know, and that's before we even get into kind of the pre-draft shenanigans. Feel confident putting them at 30, but if there's anyone else that you would think did especially well, especially poorly, obviously, you know, San Antonio, Dallas had good things happen for them, but
I think what happened with San Antonio is pretty amazing, especially yesterday. You know, I feel like David West is almost getting commended a little too much. I mean, he made a choice. You know, he chose to win over the money. The winning was worth more than the money to him, and he went where, you know, where he maximized his own personal value and stuff. But that San Antonio was able to pull off stuff like that over and over, and that they got LaMarcus and stuff, I think, yeah, that's a pretty amazing offseason. I think the Knicks and in some ways had the most interesting offseason. I don't understand Derek Williams for the life of me. That seems to stand out like a bit of an outlier, though, among the first offseason in a while where the Knicks seemed like, you know, something actually that made sense was going on.
And you can, you know, 2 years, okay. You know, it's, even if that's a mistake, it's not a, you know, it's a, you know, you can squint your eyes and say former second overall pick. But, you know, okay, we have him 1 year after this one. If that's the worst thing they do, if that's the worst thing Phil Jackson does from you know, from henceforth, he will have done well, I think.
I absolutely agree with that. Yep, I absolutely agree with that. Yeah, and a lot of the good they do seems to be different. If anything, it's just such a different style of offseason than they've had the last few years. I feel like everybody will remember what Sacramento, it's funny, though, as bad as the offseason is, there's a few things they did that I like. I'm most embarrassed to say, but I mean, I like Kostas Kupas quite a bit. I don't necessarily understand the contracts, of course, given the other members of the team. And I actually thought Cauley-Stein was great. I mean, Cauley-Stein's a guy who actually was really hoping the Celtics were going to get, maybe trading with Charlotte for the nine to get him or something. Yeah, presumably he has feet, but if his feet work. So I do actually like a couple of pieces they bought. I don't understand how
they got there.
Constitutes a basketball team. Yeah, I don't know how they got there. I don't know how this is a basketball team that they put together. It doesn't seem remotely like a basketball team.
Sure. No, and actually, I kind of want to, if I may, and it's my soapbox, my podcast, so I may. I'm going to soapbox
the ball.
For a second. I'm going to, on David West. You know, people one thing that I've seen that's annoying is people who have been talking in language like the Spurs are exploiting him somehow, or exploiting players. If it's exploiting them to like to work there and be willing to work for less, that, you know, like you said, David West had a choice. He could have made $5 million, like, was it the 4-8 or something like that in Washington. So, and you're going to say that your judgment about what he should do is better than his? I categorically reject that and say, you know, that's if San Antonio is a good place to work, they do, and which it is, it's a workplace. It's not just a font for our enjoyment. Then they deserve to enjoy some of the benefit of that, and you know, the fact that they, you know, in general stick out as being a well-run business, not just a team amongst other teams, should give other teams pause, not be something that we look down on San Antonio for. And that's the end of my rant there. So anyway.
I feel the same way, not surprisingly. I think, you know, as an obvious, ridiculous Boston sports homer, I have the Patriots situation as well. And I think you hear a lot of analogies between the Patriots and the Spurs so many times. And so I think we're used to it with the way we deal with, we don't want to get into certain aspects of what we're doing vis-a-vis the Spurs. But yeah, I think it's the same kind of thing. The idea that the Spurs are abusing players in any way, I think, is hilarious. It makes no sense to me at all. Everybody there seems to be very, very, very happy with the choice they've made. I've yet to hear a guy come out of there and say, oh, shit, I wish I'd have taken more money elsewhere. I don't think we've heard that one time, right? I think everybody is very happy with the choice they made to go to San Antonio. And you know, you see the wagering markets already put out lines for next year, and San Antonio has leapfrogged ahead of Golden State already. It's Cleveland, then San Antonio, then Golden State, then OKC, and no one even close. It's really those four teams, and then a huge, huge gap between everybody else. So the market loves San Antonio's move. They've yet again leapfrogged. You know, they leapfrogged the defending champion a couple weeks after the season ended. Immediately.
I feel like that might be without diving into the numbers, I kind of feel like that's a slight overreaction, just because, you know, Aldridge is good, but again, we don't know how he's going to fit. You know, a guy whose value was in many ways soaking up a lot of decent but not great possessions and not turning the ball over and doing all the things, you know, the versatile things that he does. It's going to a team that, you know, not all that stuff is really needed. How much, you know, he's better than Thiago Splitter, but in there's some risk that it's not in the right ways. So I don't know.
I feel the same. I want to disagree with you more to make the podcast more interesting. But I agree here as well. Yeah, I can't disagree on this one. I'm not totally sure yet how he fits. I'm pretty darn confident they're going to figure out a way to make him fit pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
In that but I don't know precisely what it's going to be yet. We don't know if Manu or Duncan falls off a cliff this year. It's at least possible. We don't know if Parker's fallen off a cliff already. That's definitely very possible. I think they're going to miss Corey Joseph. Again, I'm sure they're going to find a way to handle most things. But, you know, Kyle Anderson, a lot more minutes now. I think we're not sure exactly how that's going to go yet. But there's enough uncertainty to me that I'm surprised they leapfrog Golden State, for example. I can't necessarily yet justify how San Antonio is ahead of Golden State in someone's power ranking for next year. They may very well end up being a better team. I think it's very possible. But given the uncertainty and the age issue, I don't exactly understand what sense that made. I know a few other guys say, too, who, when those lines came out, was a bit surprised by that. Currently, you can bet something like $500 or something. So there's not a lot of money behind those lines, but those kind of lines, yeah, they're very, very, very illiquid. The lines aren't based on too much. So I think if they were opened up for people like us, I think they would not remain in the current order. Yeah. But, yeah, right now, Cleveland's a monster favorite for next year. Of course, that's mostly because the assumption is the other three best teams are going to have to battle it out to get to Cleveland. But right now, Cleveland is a monster favorite.
Sure. So, are there other teams that you've liked, disliked their off seasons particularly? I mean, obviously the Clippers and the Blazers are going to take steps back next year. I don't necessarily know. You can't necessarily blame them because, I mean, a guy made a choice. So,
I think I'm right too. I I get into a few interesting discussions a few days ago for the Clippers. So, I mean, obviously the offseason went pretty poorly. But I don't understand the notion that many people have them not making the playoffs, and I don't understand. I think Blake and Chris Paul and Paul Pierce and Doc and, you know, me and seven of my buddies would make the playoffs. I think it's highly likely to make the playoffs. Granted, it was a terrible offseason, but I think it's highly, highly, highly likely to make the playoffs still. And I feel like I see a lot of the predictions out there have them between seventh and ninth, I'm not sure I understand that. I'm not justifying what happened with their offseason. Obviously, it didn't go as they want. DeAndre being the big part of that, there's a lot of talk about the DeAndre move to the Clippers, off the Clippers and towards Dallas. I think people are not realizing how good DeAndre is going to be in Dallas. The pick and roll they're going to run with him there in Dallas now with Parsons and with Dirk out there spacing, I think DeAndre Jordan is going to be a monster in Dallas. I know Mark Cuban has said a lot about him being a monster in Dallas, but he's rather biased, right? I think DeAndre Jordan is going to be a monster in Dallas.
He said 25,000 things, apparently, about it. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Right.
So, that's right. That's right. Forget about that. That's right. Yeah.
So, I think that's the thing that people in general, you know, don't realize is that DeAndre Jordan is a probably better offensive player than defensive player. That would you agree with me on that? That his, you know, I guess kind of taking rebounding out of it, because that's a whole other kind of kettle of fish. But the fact that he, like, you know, if you look at players who've taken at least 2,500 shots in their NBA career, he has the most accurate shooter in air quotes, of all time by a huge margin. And, you know, some of that is obviously playing, you know, several years with Chris Paul and whatnot. But, I mean, he has a case for being, certainly in the modern era, like the most effective finisher, like, ever. And that's not nothing. So
that reminds me of a couple of years ago when ESPN published an article saying that Andre Drummond was the best shooter in the NBA. That was the title, best shooter in the NBA, Andre Drummond. And it made me really laugh because, you know, when we talk about this, and I think that's the difficulty. I think people see the free throws and they see that he has not much there but the pick and roll and the dunks and the lobs. And I think a lot of people discount the pick and rolls, the dunks and the lobs. And, man, there's so much value in pick and rolls, dunks and lobs. And I think it's hard to see inside the noise of all the free throw picks and free throw apples and the hack of DeAndre and stuff. But, yeah, just pick and rolls and lobs and dunks, man. That can make a really, really good offensive player, yeah.
And it's not just him, but it's also the fact that, you know, the other team's defense has to do things to not allow those lobs and dunks and things like that.
Yep.
And that's almost where the Clippers, I think, again, the Clippers will miss him as much there as they do on defense. I mean, it's like the reason why, like, the Chris Paul, Blake Griffin pick and roll, middle pick and roll is so deadly is that, you know, Blake Griffin catches the ball at the free throw line and you can't run at him, because if you do, then he throws the lob to DeAndre and you get dunked on and put on SportsCenter. And so that just puts the defense in impossible spots, which it no longer will be the case, sadly. Who has had an offseason that you haven't, you know, liked? More of their kind of their own doing rather than, again, it's hard to totally blame the Blazers. Actually,
right.
Talking about the Blazers, I kind of like how they've recovered, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, I guess there's some their fault. I'm a little confused by the moves Phoenix made. I don't know that I dislike them per se, and maybe I don't dislike them. I think they were made in a real push to get altered or a real push to go for it now. I think Chandler is a wonderful player, and obviously he's going to make them better. I'm a little confused over the Chandler with Len. I mean, they seem to do a lot last year to optimize playing Len as much as they could and try to see what direction they'd go with that. And he seems to have played pretty well, and now that's going to change drastically. I'm a little underweight on Brandon Knight compared to most. I like his age a lot, and he seems to be a good kid, but I'm a bit underweight on Brandon Knight. So I find Phoenix's offseason a bit interesting, and I'm not sure. It seems to me like they're trying to stamp themselves in a very firm, solid position in ninth place. And I don't know how long you want to stamp yourself really solidly down in that number nine and number 10 spot. And
yeah.
It looks to me like they're spending a lot of money to stamp themselves down at ninth or 10th in the Western Conference. And I think long run, that's probably about as bad, about as bad a thing as you can do. So, yeah, I guess Phoenix for me would be my – I'm a little confused what direction they went in. Trading Markieff as well. Now that Marcus has gone, I guess the rumors they may trade Markieff and stuff too. It just seems to be a very different situation than it was in 2014 when Horace came in. And, you know, I think a lot of the guys in the wagering markets who did well that year got onto the Phoenix train early as well. And I don't know, things seems to have decelerated since then. They certainly haven't improved since then. It seems like they had this monster year in 2014. They didn't quite make it. And now maybe did the more long-run harm than good. It seems like they try to float away in the playoffs and they're not quite making it. I think they're probably not going to make it again. And I'm not sure where exactly they go from here.
They didn't. They did not handle the unexpected prosperity very well. It's kind of like the, you know, you hear the things about people who win the lottery and 5 years later are broke because they just got too many big ideas too soon and the good luck runs out. You know, it's like almost like they had all the good luck they had 2 years ago. They had kind of none of last year. Like 2 years ago, they had great chemistry and all that stuff. And then last year, like with all the talent they had by most accounts pretty. I don't know if it's chemistry so much. It's just the turmoil. You know, whether it's, you know, the more eye getting technicals or the 3-point guards not working together or so on. So,
The amazing chemistry in 2014 can seem to really have fallen apart. I don't know. I think it maybe started with the Bledsoe thing last year with all the difficulty re-signing him and then led into Dragic being a little upset. And I don't know. I think everybody was so happy and they all got together so well in 14 and then in 15, little cracks started to come in. I'm no longer enamored with the position there. And in 2014, I thought them along with the Celtics, I think looked really good. And now, obviously, I'm biased in this, but I'm no longer that enamored with the position Phoenix is in. I think they may have made some pretty significant errors. But again, as I say a lot, I am wrong a whole lot, and it's definitely possible that I missed the boat here. That Brandon Knight turns out to be a lot better than I thought, or that he matches up well together with Bledsoe or something. So I guess it's definitely possible. You know, maybe Archie Goodwin's going to become a superstar, and I just don't see it. So I don't know. But for me right now, I'm very confused by the direction Phoenix would go.
Sure. Is there anyone else you would kind of, if you were looking at a team kind of that this year's Milwaukee kind of a team that's going to jump up? I think that the one team everyone's looking at is probably Utah. And not necessarily haven't necessarily done anything this offseason other than just being a year older and a full year of playing Rudy Gobert starters minutes instead of Enes Kanter. But they're one team. If I'm not stealing your answer, but
no, that's okay. I mean, if they were in the Eastern Conference, I would like them a lot this year. Yeah, like you said, just everybody getting a year older. I think a lot comes down to how well Gobert and Favors are going to play together, and how much of a second year bump they get at a guy like Exum. I have no idea how good he is. He looked pretty good the other night in summer league against Marcus, I guess, but He could take a huge second year leap this year. We even have in our model, we have a discontinuous leap for second year guys. You know, there's a lot. I think that's why a lot of second year guys come in summer league and people think they're superstars. And I think that there needs to be a relaxing element there for guys, second year guys who come in summer league, because it's just such a different thing being a second year playing against some of the rookies.
Sure.
But, you know, putting that aside for a second, just in general, a second year NBA players, sometimes they have a really big leap. And I guess we don't know where Exum's going to be there. I think it's a hoot watching summer league and seeing guys go crazy over some of the second years. I mean, I love Aaron Gordon, so I'm doing it there too. I get it.
Yeah.
I'm tweeting like crazy every time Aaron Gordon does something, but you know, he's playing against kids. He's playing against people older than him. Granted, everybody's still older than him on the court, but I think a lot of the second year players who dominate in summer league needs to be tempered. Now, this goes the opposite of what I was saying in the first place. So what I was saying in the first place is that we model a pretty explicit second year kind of discontinuous leap for certain guys. And I guess, you know, I think we saw that with Gobert last year. I think we may see that with Exum this year. Obviously, Utah is really promising to me. I guess I still come down to thinking that a lot goes on Gobert. So how good of an offense can you make with the two of them playing together? And I guess time will tell. I do agree, though. I'm agreeing with you too much. I wish I could disagree. They're a team that definitely could be. They're a team that definitely could be this year's Milwaukee.
No, it's funny that you talked about the second year, because I recorded a podcast earlier today with Doug Eberhard of SB Nation and other places, and he was talking about how kind of a similar thing, how, you know, if you look at the rookies in summer league, they're all moving 9 million miles an hour, and the second year guys have kind of known how to have figured out how to use the throttle a little bit, so that just naturally makes, even with no kind of difference in anything else, that just makes the guys who are already professionals just look so much better in a summer league setting, just because they are it's not they're moving slower, it's that they're pacing themselves, they're changing pace. They're, you know, you can see it most with like the first year point guards. They're just like, I'm going around a screen roll, I'm going really fast, whereas second year guys are like, I'm coming to a screen, I'm going 80%, now I'm going, and it just, you just look so much better in that. And not necessarily any difference in how you'll do an actual NBA play, but in that setting, you look great. So
one of my favorite articles that you've written, actually, was, I believe it was early-ish, not this past season, but I think the one before, and if I, you know, time's messing up, pretty much, really sure, but I was on John Wall, and it was the same thing. I think people know Cousins and Wall pretty much my favorite, and Gordon pretty much my favorite non-Celtics, but you had a really good article on Wall and how it's always 100 miles an hour now. He has to just learn to slow it down a little bit, you know, a little delay, a little jump step here or there. And he is now doing that, I think, substantially better. And that's, I think, made him change completely. And then just seeing him on defense especially, totally different guy, I think, because his head's so much in the game. For me, I think when you watch the rookies versus the two-year guys in summer league, yeah, it's sometimes it's just hilarious. just hilarious, the difference there.
Sure. One other team I wanted to ask you about, the team that, and it's, they're getting, in my mind, kind of an Eastern Conference bump, and it's a team that I think that you're kind of in on based on you're in on, at least as a viewer, if not you know, for other reasons, is the Magic. Obviously, I think Utah's going to be a better team, but, you know, the Eastern Conference, better, maybe, who knows. Maybe they can be this year's Milwaukee. Am I going overboard if you know, because I'm thinking with their offseason, maybe Aaron Gordon's going to play the four more, and I like their lineup much better that way than other ways. And I don't know what do you think of the Magic going forward?
I think that's definitely a possibility. Vaughn was just a terribly disappointing coach. I think he's a surprisingly disappointing coach, and Skiles is going to be a one. I mean, Skiles had, I think, the highest coach record of anybody that was not currently signed, of any unsigned coach, for most of the last couple of years. So,
God, for
presumably big.
Oh.
So, yeah, I know. Oh, God, I know. Yeah.
Hey,
I know. That's the problem.
I will die on the Scott Brooks is not that bad hill. So that's.
I think he'll look a lot better now. I assume. I think Coach Rappin looks bad in parts because Scott Brooks is too high. I think he'll come down to a more normal place this year, I think, in the rankings tables. Yet another rankings table, people shouldn't look at as much, I think, the rankings table. But yeah, I think Orlando had a big coaching change. They're going to have that second-year leap from Gordon and probably from Peyton as well. Tobias Harris is much younger than it seems, I think, so he presumably could get a lot better. I think we'll see what Skiles can do with Vucevic on defense. They have no rim protection of any kind, and they even lost O'Quinn, so maybe Skiles can fix that. Maybe they're going to get some rim protection out of Aaron Gordon as well somehow or something. I don't think that's actually unreasonable. I think he can probably provide a little. I like him at the four for sure.
Yeah.
I also like Tobias Harris. I like Harris at the four for sure, so I guess I'm not totally sure how that's going to work.
Sure.
I definitely think they'll be a much better team than they were. You know, getting rid of Ridenour only helps. I mean, they had some of the atrocious players, the atrocious minutes distribution last year. I assume that will change. I think some of the Milwaukee effect, I think, is how good the team just happens to play early in the year. And if Milwaukee just happened to go 5-12 to start the season, even if it was randomly, it could be very different. If Orlando starts the season 12-5 or something, they're going to play totally differently than if they start 5-12. And I think that's something. I think there's a bit of a luck element that pops into on some of that stuff. But I can totally see Orlando, if they start this season really good, they're gonna go balls to the wall trying to make the playoffs. I assume. I don't know how realistic that is, but I think it's at least reasonable.
I mean, you mentioned that. I think 2 years ago, we kind of saw that with Phoenix a little too. I think if they start the season differently, then if they're not really good for the first, you know, half of the season, then they probably had made some more trades and moved some, you know, maybe moved Dragic or something like that, that season. Right. And so they,
I think that's definitely true. Yeah. I think that's definitely true. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me see. I've kept you for right around the hour that I said I would. Any other kind of off-season thoughts, things you're looking forward to going into next season? I'm kind of interested to see what. Obviously, Cleveland is going to continue to be fascinating, but I'm interested to see what we're going to see from Kevin Love next year. And part of that is, it's funny. I was kind of on the he's not that good. And when I said not that good, it's like people were talking about him as like the, you know, our favorite rankings. People were talking about him as like the fourth or fifth best player in the league. And I was like, slow down. And now it seems like people are going the other way and like wondering why they even re-signed him. And I don't think that's necessarily the wisest people are saying that, but still. So I'm interested to see kind of if he's healthier this year, how he settles in, whether they can use him better, whether his best kind of fit with their overall talent is, you know, as kind of a weak side spot-up shooter guy. Anything you're particularly looking forward to?
I think how he plays this year is going to be really interesting as well. I assume him to regress back. Yeah, I assume his numbers to regress positively towards his old norms a little bit. I assume him to figure out his role a little bit better. I assume the longer contracts, a little more certainty may help. I assume it'll all get better. I'm not 100,000% sure that it's the best fit, but I mean, they're all so good that I think it's fine. I'm not sure, you know, LeBron, Love, and Kyrie can really be a bad fit. I think a really interesting team for next year. I mean, it sounds boring, but I think that's why it's interesting is Golden State. They haven't made any change. You know, they're just coming back with the same team, and it's almost like San Antonio does normally. It looks boring, but I don't think it's boring at all. They're bringing back an amazing, a pretty young, a really dynamic team that no one other than maybe Cleveland at the end had much an answer for all year. I mean, they were the best team in the league from day one till the end. And you know, next year they're bringing back the same guys, and some of them are going to get better. You know, Klay Thompson still should get better. Draymond should get better. Curry is in his prime. I doubt he's going to get much worse from 27 to 28. Azeal is going to get better. Harrison Barnes might get better. So, I mean, I think Golden State is very interesting for next year, and they just don't look interesting now because they were just so interesting last season. But
it's also going to be seeing just kind of how kind of almost ephemeral their near perfection last year was is the flip side of that. And, you know, again, they talk about it, they had fairly perfect kind of chemistry and stuff like that, starting with, you know, Iguodala accepting the bench role and stuff like that. And not saying that they're going to be, you know, all infighty and stuff or anything. It's just it's going to be from, you know, from superb to good, and if that makes a difference or something like that, I don't know. I think we almost saw that a little bit with San Antonio last year. I mean, 2 years ago, after their finals loss to Miami, they had kind of that, you know, they talked a lot about kind of that focus and everything about how losing in that painful way kind of, you know, all the cliches about drive and focus and blah blah blah. And naturally, they didn't have that coming into last season and, you know, made little differences here and there, which add up.
I agree with that. I think they also got a little lucky a few times this year here or there. They have a few lucky breaks, and I'm sure some of that luck will regress back a little bit. I think what's interesting about them is really the youth, that they're somehow still very, very young. Very, very young. But, yeah, they had a lot of luck. And luck, I think, more than anything else, tends to really regress. Luck is probably the thing that regresses the most. You know, they definitely had a lot of positive luck. I'm not sure that the positive luck mattered. I think they'd have won the title regardless. I think they'd have won the title if Kyrie got hurt regardless. But, yeah, they definitely were lucky, and definitely luck tends to regress. I still am surprised and don't see how, other than a very illiquid market being the reason, I don't see how or why San Antonio would be favored over Golden State right now today, though. I think that's kind of like how Michael Jordan didn't win the MVP every year or something. You know, I feel like Golden State is just it's easy to bypass Golden State with San Antonio. I think that was a really easy move for people to make, and it seems to be done too fast to me, too rushed, too fast.
actually, I think there's a final point I want to end on. When you say luck, I think that you know, based on your work and kind of my background, working in I was a card player in a former life, obviously, the concept of luck is not a pejorative, and I think that's something that people need to you know, luck is kind of a necessary but not sufficient condition in a lot of cases for success. Is that and whether it's, you know, injuries or a draft pick panning out because, you know, nobody knows anything, would you say that the average fan is not, again, horribly leading the witness, but the average fan is not as cognizant of the role luck is playing as they should be?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. We're talking about games with 200 points scored in them where to decide who wins or loses. And, you know, a few of these in a season, look at the Cleveland title the Miami title over San Antonio a couple of years ago. I mean, it was just such a hair, and it could have been the other way. I do think the casual fan greatly underestimates the role of luck. Greatly times a million. Understates the role of luck in NBA basketball.
And that's, you know, up and down the, like, you know, does Scott Brooks still have a job if Anthony Davis doesn't hit a double clutch three to win a game in, was it February or something like that? And just it's just up and down the league how much that stuff kind of matters and how much it plays into kind of the narrative storytelling, which, you know, the narrative storytelling is why it's interesting to us. But still, it's easy to get carried away on that.
So it's time for me to ask you a question. So when are you going to get a job with an NBA team? When are you going to get a job with an NBA team or on a big network like ESPN or something like you should have? What's the deal here?
Oh, that's very kind of you. We're going to Summer League, so look me up, guys.
There you go.
ESPN
ESPN and 30 other teams have to wake up.
That's incredibly kind of you to say, but
there's
a lot of smart people out there, Anyway, thanks so much for the time. And now I'm completely flustered because you caught me off guard there. I appreciate you taking the time, and I know you get asked to do kind of these a fair amount, and I very much appreciate you coming on and talking with me for an hour, even if we were just kind of leading a tent-side revival of thou shall not pray to one number metrics.
That's totally fine. I had a really good time. I was happy to do it.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening to the Make or Miss podcast. We'll be back later this week with more.